So as we were sitting our long retreat this last week, leading up to our women's ancestors ceremony, which we did on Friday, one of our senior woman teachers in the lineage family fell at her home in California and went into a coma. And she spent the last several days of our Sesshin time, our retreat time, lying unconscious, surrounded by friends and students. Until then, she passed away on Sunday morning, the day after the end of our Samish Sesshin. So this is a teacher in California. Her name was Sobun Catherine Tanis. I think she was in her middle or late 80s. She started Zen practice with Suzuki Roshi sometime in the early 1960s, I think. At the time, she was in her late 30s, and most of the other students were like 20 or 19, so she was an old person at the time, from their point of view. And Catherine Tanis was one of the sort of core, there was a group of maybe, I don't know how many, a lot. You know, it's amazing that the San Francisco Zen Center just started at a perfect, certain moment in time when people were just able to give their lives over to it for decades. So Catherine was one of those people who lived in residence for some decades. And I met her in 1987 when we were sitting a Sesshin in the large basement Zendo at San Francisco Zen Center's city center building, big building they have, they own a whole block, and they converted the basement to a Zendo, big enough for about 100 people. I think it was full. And I think it was the first seven-day Sesshin I ever sat, and she was like right across from me. And I don't know if I ever exchanged any words with her, but I was really impressed with her, just her bearing and the way she was. And I learned a really useful thing about the meal form, the formal Oryoki meal form, which is that I learned from Catherine by watching her, if you get something stuck between your teeth in Oryoki, which is a very sort of formal, polite, sort of Japanese thing, it's polite to cover your mouth and stick your finger in there. Oh. Turns out. So I always remember that. It's useful sometimes. So it's strange for me, you know, because I don't really know her, and there's quite a large number of people from the American Zen movement, and especially San Francisco Zen Center, whom I have just memories like that of. You know, I don't know if I ever talked to her in person. I just felt a lot of connection, and somehow as a 21-year-old, 22-year-old student in that time, I was just a sponge for all this. I wasn't even sure if I was interested in the long-term in Zen practice, you know, I was just like kind of trying it on, is how I felt. But somehow I just had these impressions and these memories of people that I hold inside me from what was happening, from my point of view, 25 years ago, in this kind of interesting society, little society of Zen practice in California. And then each of us has that. Each of us has within us these histories, these impressions, these connections with other human beings and other plants and animals and places that somehow we keep warm in our heart. We're each of us a kind of a time capsule. And it's hard to remember that each person we meet is a different time capsule, a completely different set of this, whatever it is. And it's more than just memories, isn't it? It's more than just thoughts. It's something sort of warmer and more connected than that. And that's how I feel about Catherine Tanis, even though I never, don't know if I saw her again at Green Gulch or at Tassajara, I don't remember, but I remember her at Sesshin getting the stuff out between her teeth with her finger. Makes me think also of other people in the Sangha and peace of we meet. I was talking to Dorothy Hoskins about a month ago, who's a member here. She's maybe 78 or 79. And she was telling me how much she loves to see the flowers on the altar here. Has she told you the story? The reason why she loves to see the flowers on the altar is that when she was growing up on a farm in Oklahoma in the 1930s, they were too poor to really be able to afford land or money for seed and water and fertilizer for flowers. So they didn't really have flowers. They had a small kitchen garden, and then the crops started very close to the edge of the house. And went off into the distance as far as you can see. And that was still barely enough to support their family in those days. So she has that time capsule in her, and that flowers bring that to mind for her all these years later, so, you know, 70 years later. And that every one of us sitting here, or anybody who listens to this at home, if the batteries hold out, each of us is a kind of a trustee in a way, you know, a trustee of reality. Not that we cling to our memories or think that our memories are better than someone else's memories, but there's a richness there that we can't deny that comes forward into our life all the time. And sometimes when something dramatic happens, or we have something in the past that was dramatic, it comes forward really strongly, like when somebody dies, then we bring something to that turning, to that moment. Another connection I have with Catherine Tanis is that she ended up being the abbot, or abbess, I'm not sure which term she used, of the Santa Cruz, California Zen Center a couple of years after I left Santa Cruz, because I went to college there. But I never met her there either. I was sitting there at the Santa Cruz Zen Center, I think starting about 1985 or 86. I'd stop there on my bike and join the morning practice, which now I think of it as like our Saturday morning practice. There were like three people there. And yet it was very, somehow very important to me. I didn't really understand it. I didn't really talk to them about it. I remember one time they invited me to tea, and I just liked the idea of that. It was too overwhelming. I never went inside the house. I only went into the Zendo, would sit with them, chant the Heart Sutra, and get back on my bike and ride up to the university. But later, a little bit later, Catherine Tanis was the abbot, and earlier at that same center, Cobencino was a teacher there, Edie's first teacher. So there's these webs. And that right now, our dear friend and Sangha member, Chris Burkhart, is practicing. Maybe at this very moment, she's at Santa Cruz Zen Center practicing. She's spending a year in Santa Cruz working for some complicated, clever retirement reasons of her own. And she didn't really even expect to be sitting regularly at the Santa Cruz Zen Center, but it turns out because of where she's living and her schedule and how intense it is, she's sitting more there than she ever sat here. She goes there every day. Yeah, and it's just she lives downtown and it's close, and they have more of a daily schedule there, and teachers in residence, so it's easier for them to maintain a daily schedule. So she's there a lot. And she was part of the group that was sitting at Catherine's bedside while we were in Sesshin. She was sitting with Catherine, with the teachers and members and friends. You know, I'm sure not a lot. She was working, but she was there at least a few times. And I think she was around, I'm not sure about the exact moment, but she was around there on the morning when she died, on Sunday morning. So we have so many connections, you know, and there's so many ways that our lives touch each other across time and across space. Each life impossible to really hold or symbolize completely. And there are billions of these lives, right? Billions. Each one so rich, so full. So here's a poem, I've mentioned before that the great benefit of Dharma transmission turns out to be you get on very exclusive email lists. So I'm on exclusive Zen teacher email lists now. So I see the inner workings of the American Zen establishment, at least the ones that choose to write email, you know, squabbles and beautiful things and everything. Yeah, there's some really bad squabbles about a month ago. Lately it's been very beautiful. And so there were many appreciations on the email of Catherine and people talking about times they'd practice with her. And one woman sent this poem by Jane Hirschfield, in memory of Catherine. So I want to share this poem with you. It's called Rebus. And then there's a note, I'll tell you the note first. The note at the end is, a rebus is a representation of words in the form of pictures or symbols, often presented as a puzzle. So sort of words representing pictures, representing words. So here's the poem, Rebus, by Jane Hirschfield. You work with what you are given, the red clay of grief, the black clay of stubbornness going on after, clay that tastes of care or carelessness, clay that smells of the bottoms of rivers or dust. Each thought is a life you have lived or failed to live. Each word is a dish you have eaten or left on the table. Their honeys so bitter, no one would willingly choose to take them. The clay takes them, honey of weariness, honey of vanity, honey of cruelty, fear. This rebus, slip and stubbornness, bottom of river, my own consumed life, when will I learn to read it? Painfully, slowly, uncolored by hope or desire, not to understand it, but only to see. As water given sugar sweetens, given salt grows salty, we become our choices. And yes, we become our choices. Each yes, each no continues. This one a ladder, that one an anvil or cup. The ladder leans into the darkness. The anvil leans into the silence. The cup sits empty. How can I enter this question the clay has asked? Rebus, work with what you are given. The red clay of grief, the black clay of stubbornness going on after. Clay that tastes of care or carelessness. Clay that smells of the bottoms of rivers or dust. Each thought is a life you have lived or failed to live. Each word is a dish you have eaten or left on the table. There are honeys so bitter no one would willingly choose to take them. The clay takes them. Honey of weariness, honey of vanity, honey of cruelty, fear. This rebus, slip and stubbornness, bottom of river, my own consumed life. When will I learn to read it? Painfully, slowly, uncolored by hope or desire, not to understand it, but only to see. As water given sugar sweetens, given salt grows salty, we become our choices. Each yes, each no continues. This one a ladder, that one an anvil or cup. The ladder leans into the darkness. The anvil leans into its silence. The cup sits empty. How can I enter this question the clay has asked? So it's Jane Horsfield. I'll put it on the internet. You don't have to. Yeah. And the choice of this poem to honor Catherine Tanis, who had just died, is extra touching if you know who sent it. I think it's okay to say who sent it. It was sent by a woman named Shinge Roko Sherat. And Shinge Roshi is the new abbot of the Zen Studies Society in Japan, which is one of our American Zen sanghas that has been really rocked and torn apart by sexual misconduct. So she knows what she's talking about all that. Yes, no, sweet, salty. That her teacher, whom I think she really, you know, loves very much, and, you know, probably doesn't know what to think about, has been a serial sexual predator for decades, it turns out. Edo Shimano is his name. And, at the very same time, a skillful, powerful Zen teacher who has helped many, many people to heal and understand their life and understand the way of Zen practice, and has many very upright, very moral, you know, disciples. So it's very strange, you know, what we have in us. So who knows what Edo Shimano has in him that has caused him to molest and confuse, and we don't think quite rape, but, you know, close, very close, and abusing his, you know, spiritual and charismatic power to convince women to have sex with him. So I don't know what Catherine Tanis thought about that, or if she and Shinge ever talked about it, but I was really struck by her choice of that poem, given what she's working on. Because we have so much darkness in us, too. So our practice has to be a celebration of the whole thing, right? Or else it's not real, it's not honest. And sometimes during our intensive retreats, like the one we just had, we become more aware of the darkness in us. Each other person is mirroring our light and our darkness. And Norman actually spoke about the physics of light. I'm not sure if his physics was always quite perfect. That's my dad, but it was cool, though, nonetheless. He made good spiritual points. That we have inside all of us, the honey that's so bitter that no one would take it, right? We have within us the weariness, the vanity, carelessness. Late in Sashin, I said something hurtful to somebody, and it was really painful to see that darkness coming out of my lips. And we worked it out and apologized, and I think both of us knew, what we say is in a way completely our responsibility, right? We said it. In a way, it's emerging from a complex web of causes and conditions in us that we barely understand. So the darkness is there, and we work with it. We notice it when it arises. We take responsibility. And bringing forth this darkness allows us to stop hiding. We recognize in our sense of separation from others that we are kind of caught in a double bind all the time a little bit. On the one hand, we really want to be seen, right? We want to be recognized. We want to be made whole through the mirror of the seeing of others. We want to be seen as a full person, worthy and awake. But at the same time, we want to hide the wicked thought, the meanness, the cruelty, the depression, the addiction that is also in us. So somehow our process is unfolding and being a mirror for each other's in our Sangha life and our Zen practice has to find ways to include and allow for the light and the darkness, and to allow people to express both sides with full support from us. Being careful about how we respond, sometimes just giving people space to express the dark side of their life, that it's not necessarily a cry for help or something we have to fix or repair. It could be just letting it out, letting it breathe. So here's a talk Catherine Tanis herself gave in 2003. And in the beginning of her little talk, she quotes the same poet, Jane Hirschfield. So here's what Catherine Tanis says about this being hidden and mirroring. And she's not exactly making the same point I'm trying to make, but it's close. It's interesting. I only know of a few talks of hers that are published online. And she's not some priests who are like constantly writing books and recording themselves and spreading their juju all over the internet. And I'm afraid I seem to be one of those. And her teacher, Norman, is too. But many other priests, not so much, Talks aren't recorded. It's just really about the situation, being where they are. Once in a while, they write a short talk for the newsletter, and maybe that gets published or somebody types it up. So this is one of those kind of talks, short talk in a newsletter sometime. Catherine wrote, in a recent essay, the poet Jane Hirschfield writes, at Ryonji in Kyoto, there's a famous rock garden. This is a very famous rock garden. In the way it's designed, wherever in it a person stands, one of the 15 rocks cannot be seen. The garden reminds that always something unknowable is present, just beyond what can be perceived or comprehended, and that something is as much part, and that something, the thing that's hidden, is as much part of the real as any other stone amid the raked gravel. Read that again. At Ryonji in Kyoto, there's a famous rock garden. Wherever in it a person stands, one of the 15 rocks cannot be seen. The garden reminds that always something unknowable is present, just beyond what can be perceived or comprehended. And that something is as much part of the real as any other stone amid the raked gravel. Catherine goes on. Her beautiful essay reminds me of what one reviewer said about the late poet Philip Whalen, who was also a Zen priest, that he was not the best known of the beat poets, but his experiments and his writing allowed them to write the work that they wrote. You might say that Philip's contribution is hidden in the work of others. Because we live in the lives of others, sometimes acknowledged, sometimes not. These unrecognized connections among us are included in what we call our interdependent existence. In our last newsletter, we quoted Kobenchino Roshi, saying, "How to know your true self is something we cannot do alone. We have to do it with someone who is able to accept our vow." How to know your true self is something we cannot do alone. We have to do it with someone who is able to accept our vow. Catherine goes on, "We have to practice with someone who is big enough to perceive our deepest self, our deepest intention, and turn us to it again and again. Our true nature, our true self, is hidden in our consciousness, hidden from ourselves. A true teacher like Koben Roshi or Suzuki Roshi sees our true nature. In seeing and speaking to it, they allow us to also believe in it, to believe in our openness, receptivity, generosity, non-resistance, and loving kindness. Help us to see those things in ourselves. What is known and not known by us about our inner motivations and intentions is the investigation of practice. We know on one level, and we don't know on another level." In her essay, Jane quotes Michael Dickinson on our contradictions, that we are most comfortable being hidden, yet yearn to be seen. We are most comfortable being hidden, yet we yearn to be seen. I would add, we are quite fearful to see our inner mind. We fear what demons might lurk, and the gift of practice is to allow us to gradually be drawn into this realm of the unknown and accompanied by a trustworthy friend who can help us to enter there. And that's really experientially true in our practice, and you see it maybe more clearly in an intensive retreat. It's not like you choose to go there, you know. You're just drawn. You're drawn there. Catherine goes on, "In Christianity, the self measures or experiences itself by its receptivity to God or the universe. In Buddhism, there is no permanent identifiable self. The reality we call self, which seems to do the work of liberation, is a changing continuum, changing on every breath. Within the self, there does seem to be an unchanging self," maybe like kind of the observer of all this, which journeys through these changes and knows itself only as endless transformation, not hidden, but also seen. She goes on a bit longer, but I'll just leave that for you to read later on the web, just for time, but along that same theme. You know, the self that's sort of caught, right, in the story, in the drama, and that sense that there's something deeper, something going on a journey with that self. Not some other self that can fix that self, but a self that understands itself as a non-self, understands itself as transformation, as each moment, transformations of consciousness. And so are we just a this is me now. And so are we just a collection of light and darkness? What's hidden and what's seen? Or are we the observer of light and darkness? This unchanging self that Catherine Tonnis mentions. And of course the Buddha would remind us to not worry too much about these questions of what we actually are, only so much as it helps us to understand how to connect, how to suffer less, how to help others. We make choices, we say yes, we say no, experience unfolds the way it needs to. Suffering and confusion increases sometimes, awakening and clarity increases sometimes. So just to remind ourselves that we are a process. We process and we process, or we process and process, processing in a procession together, and living the process of our inner work together in this procession. that's another talk. It's still in the envelope. One second. Share a song with you, because I think sometimes, you know, all this is expressed, you know, through the arts, and in a way you could think about Zen practice itself as an art form, you know, not so much a technique to get something, and ritual as an art form, you know, that it's kind of like a sort of kind of a performance art piece when we sit together, you know, it is. So I'm going to try to fire this up. So one of the things we learned in Japan when we went there summer before last is that there is a contemporary Soto Zen movement called Baika. I probably mentioned this before in the slideshow about Japan. And Baika is a singing practice. And we think of Zen as sort of monotone. Blah, 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 blah. This is a melodic singing practice, which was developed in the 1950s in Japan based on another lineage of Buddhism. The Tendai and Shingon lineages. And apparently it's been very popular, and it's kind of led to a bit of a revival of Soto Zen in Japan, because it's the kind of thing that groups of people, it might be mostly groups of, you know, women, I'm not sure, can get together and really do, you know, as a community practice. And for whatever reason, Baika, maybe because it's sort of more intensely situated inside the Japanese culture, has not sort of made the leap to America the way Zazen did, the way the meditation did. And so we're in Japan, Shungo-san and his wife, Chuitsuse-san, showed us a few Baika songs, and they sang one with us that I think it was simple enough that we might be able to learn it. And so what I brought on the laptop, if I can fire it up, is a video with the audio of him singing it to us. And then I asked Karen Fitzgerald to transcribe it, that we have it in kind of Western notation. They invented this bizarre notation for Baika, which he tried to explain to us, but it made no sense to us whatsoever. And the other thing that's great about Baika, which probably would never make it to our shores, is it's not just like you sit down and sing the songs, right? This is Japan. You'll see some of this, I hope, on the video. It's small. But there's a whole ritual before you even begin to sing. And there's this little kit. In addition to singing the songs, they have a little two different kinds of little bells that they ring. And the little bells are carefully placed in a certain kind of cloth, which is wrapped in a certain way. And what he told us is, for the first 6 months of your Baika training, you're not allowed to sing or play the instruments. You attend the meeting, and you learn how to get the instruments out and put them away again properly. Right? So yeah, Americans would never do that, right? You know? Like, ah, come on, can we sing this? So, yeah. Each of us needs to kind of befriend our trusted friend without at the beginning even exactly knowing, you know, who they are. So it's a faith practice in some ways, you know, trusting that there is a trusted friend.
Right. I mean, I just think it's so easy for us to maybe project onto our teachers, make them our trusted friend, and then we brought up this whole situation with our trusted friend.
Well, and she's kind of saying that what the teacher does is just help you have faith in your own experience, right? Self. So maybe it might be that the spiritual teacher can role play a trusted friend for you as a way to help you meet that person inside, inside yourself or outside yourself. Maybe the trusted friend is a bird flying in the sky. So let me pass this out. She didn't type it up, so we hopefully can read Karen's handwriting okay. course, my other motivation here is that I'll still be around. You know, I'll be in Bellingham mostly all summer, and but I'm gonna take a little bit of a sabbatical from Wednesday night. You know, so I'm leaving you with the song. It's good. Huh? So we'll listen to him, and I'll try to explain the words, and then we'll probably sing it separately from him because he sings in a really awkward key. And and Karen transcribed it to I guess just C major for us. I'm not sure. There's no flats. There's no flats or sharps. Yeah, I think he's singing like in, you know, A minor or something like that, or A minor seventh or some difficult thing. So let me see if I can bring this up, and then I'll. And the other thing to do is scoot in really close. So scoot in here. We'll have a let's like scoot around the campfire here. Yeah, we're gonna watch something here. Let's see if we are working. Of doing the projector, but I thought maybe we can do some work. Is that a good angle?
Yeah.
So this is the grandson of the person we call Suzuki Roshi. Grandson of Shunryu Suzuki, whom he never met. And the son of Huitsu Suzuki. Who in the local scene is Suzuki Roshi, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he is Suzuki Roshi.
I wonder how many generations of priests in that.
Yeah, I don't know. Certainly, Suzuki Roshi's father was a priest.
Yeah.
I don't know about his father's father.
That's five.
And he's inside, we're inside Rinsuin Temple, outside Yaizu, Japan, about an hour on the train south of Tokyo. And this temple was founded, it's really easy to remember when it was founded, this temple was founded in 1492.
Oh.
Something good happened in 1492.
That's good.
And so it's been there for 500 years. So we're happy about 21 years, you know, in our song, about 500. So what this song is, it's Namu, can you kind of read it?
Mm-hmm.
Namu Honshi. So Namu means honor. Honshi is teacher. So honoring the teacher. Shaka is Shakyamuni, like Buddha. And Nyorai is Buddha. So that means the regular, our regular Buddha. Shaka Nyorai is Buddha. Shaka Nyorai. So it's basically just homage to the teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha. And then it's repeated with a different melody. Okay, so let's listen to Shingo-san a couple of times, and we'll try to sing it in our key.
Amen.
And so this is like the simplest song. There's this enormous songbook with much more elaborate songs, but this is one that he's trying to teach us. Let's see.
At Sogenji in Japan on the Sunday program, which was the community program, the women would do this kind of singing, and it was kind of like,
it's very elaborate.
It was very strange.
This is just without the bells, I think.
You can see his face.
I wish I had some of him talking and stuff, which was also fun. I might.
He's got a really nice voice.
Yeah, he's got a beautiful voice.
How old is he?
Late 30s, maybe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lives at the temple. That's his job, you know. People coming and going all day. He would run into town to...
Oh, this is
Kate playing Shakuhachi and me just wandering around the temple grounds.
I should put this in the projector here. Maybe we should have a movie night sometime. I should have these movies.
Maybe that's so soon.
It's going to be hard to see on the screen.
Beautiful and kind of ordinary.
I'll show you.
It sounds nice.
Back here on there.
Yeah, I did a little like walking around tour, and somehow Kate just happened to be practicing in the background.
Does that? You?
No, Kate done the canvas. Different Kate. Sadly, Kate wasn't there.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe should we go to Japan one of these years?
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we go up a little bit. It's be like, I think that would be the set. It's B there. So let's just try it and see what happens. We're already left. Should try singing with the shungo and just go up an octave. Or whatever we need to do. I thought I knew it better than I do. At least you get the relative pattern, even if we're not quite in tune with them.
And I won't sing audibly because I'll wreck it.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you.
anything to do with stuff, but Karen come with a little keyboard and just keep us on in tune.
Mm-hmm.
And we could, I think we could learn this, you know,
mm-hmm.
we have to practice
mm-hmm.
it. But isn't it beautiful? I mean, it's a devotional,
ooh,
it's devotional music, right?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds Jewish, don't it?
Does it sound a little Jewish? Yeah. Yeah, prayer.
Yeah.
It's like singing a prayer. Yeah. It does look Hebrew, but Hebrew prayer. Yeah. It makes you want to start.
That's nice.
Yeah, it does.
Well, it's very lilting in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you don't have his wife doing
that? I might. I only was able to, I might have it at home. Yeah, I was able to.
Oh.
I kind of brought the wrong disk drive, kind of. So anyway.
That's lovely. Thank you.
Welcome. Yeah, we can figure out a way to work on it little by little, but we have a start.
Ooh.
And it would just be a wonderful thing just to have it in our song, a kind
mm-hmm.
of vocabulary to be able to sing.
Mm-hmm.
This song, you know, I don't know if we'd ever go further than this in there, in the genre, but
we thought we had